Thank you all for coming back. Tonight's the third time, the third class. Tonight I thought we were going to start with the Anshei Knesset Gola, and hopefully getting a little bit into the Greeks as they started to come in. We mentioned last time that the official body that Ezra put together is called the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. And again, we're talking at the very, very beginning. It's the beginning of this, what we call the Second Commonwealth. And Ezra put together, besides he himself being a tremendous force, and he had the help of Nehemiah and others, he formed a body called the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. And this is a this body was the beginning when it started the at the beginning of the time. So it had it served a lot of functions. First of all, it was 120 members. Now, up until that time, and even after that time, it was something called the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was the highest court of the land, like the Supreme Court, if you will. In regards to the Jewish people, was the Sanhedrin. It actually had a place. The Sanhedrin had a place in the Beis Hamikdash. It was an office called the Lishkas HaGazis. It was a special room that they had cut stone, and a part of the room was that was a little outside the wall, so they were able to sit. But this was not. This was a Sanhedrin, which is a Sanhedrin plus. Because anybody who would have been on the Sanhedrin was in the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. It was 120 members at its beginning. Ezra appointed 120 members to be part of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. Today, in Israel, the Knesset has 120 members in the parliament. And where do they get that number? Why 120? Why not 100? Why not 435? Why not, you know, any other number? The answer is that they did, in fact, want to fashion it after the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. So, although maybe the quality is not as like it was, but Amir Hashem, you know, it will be. We'll get back to that quality. It was also the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. How did it end? It ended by attrition. And that was that... He appointed 120 people, and any time somebody from the Anshei Knesset HaGdola passed away, they were not replaced. And it says when you read, Pirkei Avos, so Pirkei Avos says that if you read the first Moshe Kibbutz Torah Messina, Yeshua is Kinnis Nevi'im is Sora Li Anshei Knesset HaGdola, right? So they're the line in the chain, and then the next Mishnah says, Shimon HaTzadik Hayu Mishiorei Anshei Knesset HaGdola. Shimon HaTzadik was from the last of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. So we'll talk about Shimon HaTzadik a little bit more later, but he was the last of the surviving of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. We're going to see about him. He was the one, in fact, that to meet Alexander the Great, which we'll get into that. So he was, that's how the Anshei Knesset HaGdola was finished. Now, what was the purpose of it? We mentioned last time also that the Anshei Knesset HaGdola was a legislative and judicial body. It made laws, and it judged, it was court cases as well. That's what that was its, I guess, primary function as a legislative body and a judicial body. And it was about 50, 60 years. And I mentioned Shimon HaTzadik was the last one. Now, the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, had a number of accomplishments, which really, even to today, we are the beneficiary of. Okay, we moved. Okay, good. Number one. Number two, please. Accomplishments? Now, one of the accomplishments was, as I mentioned before, from we know it is the chain, the link of the Mesorah. We could today, if we wanted to, we could trace Rebbe Talmud all the way back up to Moshe Rabbeinu. We know who my Rebbe was, Rav Hanna Leibowitz, and all the way to from his was Rav David Leibowitz in the altar of Slobodka, and his Rebbe was the altar of Kalamuza, whose Rebbe was the Rav Simcha Cecil Ziv, whose Rebbe was I'll get to it. I remember who's a Talmud of Rav Chaim Volozhin, who was a Talmud of the Gra. So we know who's Rebbe all the way back up. And in the link of the chain is Yanshei Knesset Gedolah. They were the chain, and they were like this was a very, very big transition period. It moved from what was Nevi'im and kings and Nevi'im, and it now moved into this legislative body. And from this party, we're going to actually call it the beginning of the Zugos period, which it was early Tanayim period, and Tanayim period is the time of the Gemara. So one thing is that they were the link in the chain, and one of the major things that they did is they canonized our Tanakh. Now, if you take a look on the board, it says we had about 1,000 years of prophecy. And in these 1,000 years of prophecy, there were about, I don't know exactly, but there were over 1 million Nevi'im. So you have 1 million Nevi'im and over 1,000 years of prophecy. So what do we keep with us? You know, what's in and what's out? You know, how do you determine what is going to be part of what we are going to call the Tanakh? And what are we going to call, you know, what's not in Tanakh? What are the criteria? What are what says that we Yirmiyahu is in and somebody else is out? So, just before that, just what was what was the purpose of Nevuah? What was the purpose of the Nevi'im? So, one of the main purposes of the Navi was for a person to find his tafkid in life, his purpose in life. You know, like a person, you know, is growing up. You know, today a person comes, you know, after his high school, and now he has to decide, is he going to go to Eretz Yisrael, is he not going to go to Eretz Yisrael, is he going to spend the year learning, is he going to go to, he's going to go to college, is he going to go into business? So a person has to decide, even if he is going to yeshiva, is he going to go to chinuch, is he going to go to kiruv, and what type of business? So one of the things were, one of the main jobs of a navi, you'd go to a navi, and you would tell the navi, what do I do best? You know, I guess I don't know if they had like choices like us. Maybe it was between planting tomatoes or grain. I don't know. But in fact, where should a person put his efforts in? And that's what one of the things of a navi was. We also know that a navi was for helping you find things. Let's say if you lost your car keys back then, you know, you could. How do we know this? I'm making a joke, but. We know this from Shaul, right? Shaul, how did Shaul meet Shmuel to begin with? So Shaul lost the sheep. He's looking around. What does he do? He's looking for the sheep for 2-3 days. So what does the person with him say? Hey, there's a navi in the next town. He'll help us find it. You know. So even that was, you can go to a navi and he would help you with that as well. So they had a lot of. You know, I wonder if he helped with the stock market once. Yeah, I guess. But so there was a lot of things that a navi would tell you. Again, it was open. They up until Shmuel, they say Shmuel and navi was Nevuah was not that widespread, but it came with Shmuel and navi. It took a personage like Shmuel and navi who is. You know, on the level, in the circle, so to speak, with Moshe and Aaron, right? It says, we say the Kabbalah Shabbos, right? Moshe v. Aaron, Ushmuel, Bakari Shmo, in Tehillim. And Shmuel was in that level, and when Shmuel came and he got his Nevuah, he sort of like opened it up. It was like the opening, you know, the spigot. When you open the spigot, so things come out. If you have a wider opening, so that leads more that's able to come in. And since Shmuel, when Shmuel came around, so for those, you know, for the 400 years or so since Shmuel was around, there was hundreds of thousands, millions of Nevi'im. So how do we decide what becomes part of the Torah or not? So the guidelines or the requirements was five books of Torah. Okay, so this is what they had to get it down to. They had to get it down to the Torah we had already. So we had to get it down to 19 books. That's really what we did get it down to. 19 books, 8 books of the Nevi'im, the 11 books of Ksuvim. So the criteria was that one thing is only things that were Ruach HaKodesh. Now there were a lot of things that were said in Chachma, and that was not, we're only looking for Tanakh, only things that have to do with Ruach HaKodesh. I think we even said today something, the books of Ben Sira. Ben Sira, I think, was a son of Yirmiyahu, or he was a relative related to Yirmiyahu. And his books, he also wrote books, but they were that was Chachma. They had to decide also the books of Shlomo, Keheles, Mishlei, Shir Shirim, not so much, but those two, how do you view those books? Were those books written in Chachma, which they most certainly had tremendous amounts of Chachma in? But it took the Anshei Knesset Gedolah to decide that those books were not just Chachma, but it had in it divine intuition as well, Nevuah. The second one was the Nevuah had to be for Klal Yisrael. It had to be for future, and it had to be for Klal Yisrael, for the help of Klal Yisrael. And if if anybody had the opportunity to read Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, Yeshaya, these in particular have Treyasar. Definitely have help for. They speak about the future. They speak about what Klal Yisrael is going to happen. What they need to do. They were also books that have to do with Chachma, and I'm sorry, Tochacha, Musar. These are rebukes. These are what Klal Yisrael needs to do, and lastly, halachas. Quite a number of halachas the Gemara brings down. They bring proofs from the halachas from Tanakh, from the Nach as well as from the Torah. Just in terms of Tochacha Musar, this was the Musar of Klal Yisrael. It really is a testament to the first base of the era of the first base of Mikdash. Because if you really think about it, what we have a total, I guess, 19 books. So this is what when you read the book of Malachim, which was started by, finished off by Yirmiyahu, was the book of the Tochacha of the kings for about a 400 year period. So you could imagine if you can get all the Averas, you could tell what the Averas of Klal Yisrael in general or the kings were at that time, a 400 year period in a nice concise thing. I would, just shows you what the level of Klal Yisrael was. Even though you read open the books and you think that they're all terrible people and just idol worshippers and everything, but it's just a testament that that's really all there is of the time. And just if you think about today, what would that book could be written? I don't want to say, but I don't think we'd have in 400 years we'd have a lot more written about Klal Yisrael. The second thing that they accomplished was tefillah. Tefillah is what happened with tefillah. Now, in the first base of Mikdash, tefillah was very service based. There was a concept of tefillah. We know there's a tefillah. We know it all from Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. We know Avram davened and Yitzchak and Yaakov, and there was tefillah going through Klal Yisrael. We know that Bnei Yisrael at the Yam Suf was misfalo, and how many times is it that Moshe was misfalo? But the service of Klal Yisrael was more centered around Mizbeach, of sacrifices. For the first 480 years, everybody was able to have, I take that back, Mishkan Shiloh, but for many, many years, you were able to have a little Mizbeach in your backyard, and whenever you wanted to, you would shecht, you could shecht the carbon to Hashem. When there was a certain times when the Aron was with the Mizbeach, then you couldn't sacrifice in your own backyard. And when the Beis HaMikdash came, when David and Shlomo built the Beis HaMikdash, that was it. No more bamos. Even though we do know from the times, actually the Navi itself, the Nach, actually brings it down, that they had many, many people still were sacrificing in their backyard. Some were doing it L'Shem Shemayim, some were not. but it was still being done. Their service was their service to Hashem, their avodah to Hashem was very sacrifice centered. Comes along Gullus. Now comes the destruction of the first base of Mikdash. All the Jews are sent from leaving Eretz Yisrael. About 90%, we said, went to Babel. 10% went to Egypt. Now what do they do? What happens to the Jew? How do they serve Hashem? So there was a tremendous shift on how Jews started to serve Hashem, and that's when Tefillah came in, and Jews started to use Tefillah as a mode of serving Hashem more so than sacrifices. And when they in Babel, again, we had Leviim there, we had the Talmidei Chachamim, the Sanhedrin, the cream of the crop was in Babel, and some tefillah started to come about. That and they it was formalized when they came back to Eretz Yisrael, because now they're going to come back to Eretz Yisrael, and as well as they're going to have a base of Mikdash again. So, but the Anshei Knesset Gadol, I guess, felt they didn't want to remove, they didn't want to get rid of this tefillah, this service that Klal Yisrael took upon themselves. So as a matter of fact, they actually formalized it. They set up the entire structure of Sukkot and Zimra, Berachos Kriya Shema and Shema, and of course, mainly the Shemona Esrei. So before the Anshei Knesset Gadol came about, a person would get up and he would daven to Hashem, but he'd make a list of all his needs, and he would daven. And the Anshei Knesset Gadol came, and they did a tremendous benefit for Klal Yisrael. Because now we have a structure that works. We have the Shemona Esrei, the first three brachas are praising to Hashem, and the last three brachas are thanking Hashem, and inside the rest are private needs, brachas for private needs, brachas for Klal Yisrael needs, and everything that a person could want or need is in there. It also left room for personal prayers as well. As a matter of fact, when they do archaeology in Israel, they find shuls dating back into the second base of Mikdash era. But there's no shuls that they've ever found. There was no shul. There was no such thing as a shul in the base of Knesset in the first base of Mikdash. It just wasn't there. They didn't have it. They didn't have this formalized tefillah. So this all started. This tefillah, this is something that the Anshei Knesset Gadol took, formalized, and made it all part of Klal Yisrael. Just that the only thing with the Shemona Esrei, they pretty much made the Shemona Esrei, and the only thing is they made the brachos. You know, this is going to be about chachma, this is going to be about parnasa, this is going to be about tshuva, but they didn't formalize the words exactly. And that's why coming down to us now, you can have we have at least three main girsas of how to daven. We have the Sfardim, and even in the Sfardim there are many, and Ashkenazim and Ari, but the words are a little bit off, and the Nusaf Sfardim, but the words are the idea is the same, but the words are not necessarily, you know, the exact. That probably came a lot later when they started more writing down, and people started reading from Siddurim. The one other thing is that there was, if you know the Shemona Esrei, if you realize, if you count, you'll notice that there aren't 18 brachas, but there are really 19 brachas. So where did the other bracha come from? So we're going to see later on. It came from a person by the name of Shmuel HaKatan. Katan is a small, which just means he was very, very great. Great people used to take on the word Katan. It's like a modest. But he really was that. They say if the Torah would not have been given to Moshe Rabbeinu, it could have been given through Ezra. And if it wouldn't have been given through Ezra, it could have been given through Shmuel HaKatan. So he's in that line. That's the circle that Shmuel HaKatan's in. And the bracha is Lam Al Shinim, and it refers to the slanderers, and it's a direct reference to the early Christians. The Christians before they broke off totally and became on Sunday, but they were in the shuls and they were davening among the Jews, and this bracha, there was, you know, you almost couldn't tell. You know, they were keeping Shabbos and Kashrus, and they did everything. So how would you tell? he'd tell them to get up and daven for the Amid, and they would not say Balam al Shinu, because that was a bracha against them. But I guess we'll talk about that more when we get to the Christians. Another accomplishment is the Jewish calendar. So the Jewish calendar, just a minute about the Jewish calendar. So the Jewish calendar, we today work with the Jewish calendar. The Jewish calendar today was set up by the Ashkenaz Gdola, but it was put into formation by Hillel the Fifth. There were a number of Hillels, Hillel HaZakeh and Hillel and Shammai was being the first, and if you follow 10 generations later, Hillel, he was the fifth of the Hillels, and he was the one, when he realized that the community in Eretz Yisrael was falling apart, and they would not have any, they would not be able to be the leaders of Klal Yisrael until that time, they were doing the. They were deciding when the new moon was with witnesses. That's the way it's supposed to happen. The witnesses see the new moon. They go to Beis Din, and Beis Din says Makudish Makudish, and that's the new moon. Then Beis Din has to go ahead and tell the rest of Klal Yisrael. So in the first Beis Hamikdash, it wasn't so much of a problem because most of the Jews lived within Eretz Yisrael. So by the 15th of the month, within 15 days, which is Sukkot and Pesach generally, you'd be able to get them, they'd be able to know. However, in the second Beis HaMikdash, it would be done through the Beis Din. Beis Din again would have to decide when it was. They would hear the witnesses saw the new moon, they decide Makudish Makudish. 15 days later, if it's Nisan or Tishrei, is going to be Sukkot or Pesach. And before I get to, then you have to let everybody know. And that's why today, and I noted, we'll get to exactly how they got it to Babel, how people in Babel knew about it. But what besides this, it was a calendar that the Anshei Knesset Hagdola put together. And it happens to be, and this is the calendar we use today, is a 19-year calendar. In the 19 years, there is a leap year. There's seven leap years in 19 years. Now, just what's that all about is that the solar calendar, which is goes by the sun, is a 365-day and a quarter day. That's how much it is. That's how long it takes for the Earth to go around the sun. And it takes 354 days for the moon to go around the Earth. So there's an 11 day...
12 times.
But there's a discrepancy between 11 days. So what do you do about those 11 days? So if you did nothing, so every year you lose 11 days, and that's it. So what ends up happening is your months, you know, get 11 days earlier every single year.
Like the
Muslims have a pure lunar calendar, and they have their big holiday of Ramadan comes out 11 days earlier every year. So you know, eventually it starts in the summer, and a few years later it gets earlier in the winter, and etc. We have a problem. We can't allow that to happen for one main reason, because it says Pesach has to be B'chodesh Av, it has to be in the spring. So if you did nothing, then Pesach is eventually going to come out in the in another season. It's going to come out in the winter. It's going to come out fall, summer, and that's not good. That's not a good thing. So that's why you have to add a month. So for us, a leap year is an extra month. So we add an extra month every 7 years. This calendar was made up by the Anshei Knesset Hagdola, and we had it. Klal Yisrael had it. They didn't put it into effect not for another, I think, about 700-800 years. So for the next 700-800 years, we're still using, Rebbe was in the year 200 CE. Yeah, for about 700-800 years, they were still accepting witnesses in front of a Beis Din. And finally, when they realized that there's no more a Beis Din, at that time, it was the Byzantines that were cracking down, the Romans, and the community in Israel was falling apart. So Hillel took this calendar and put it into effect. And this is the calendar that we pretty much are using today. But this calendar, this came from the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. Okay, any questions on the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah?
Still convening, but they were all in the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah as a judge.
At one point they were all there. I guess what happened is that if one person in the 120, if either when they got down to 69 of them, so they got somebody else to be part of the Sanhedrin who was not part of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, or I guess maybe it could be they had it simultaneous. You know, besides the 120, there was a Sanhedrin that was functioning, and it could be that they were, some people had both jobs. I don't know, but you're right. It was a Sanhedrin at every single time, at any point of our history. There was a Sanhedrin until we'll see that about 40 years before the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. The Sanhedrin realized they didn't have any power, and instead of staying in an office without being able to do anything, they disbanded themselves. That's about 40 years before the second Beis HaMikdash. But until that time, there was always a Sanhedrin. Now, I guess at one point they were part of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, and at some point they separated out.
They set up the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. Why did they have the vision of not having replacement and have it keep going forward? It just seems strange to set it up and not have that.
I don't know. I could speculate. I don't know if I'm right. It's just, this is a harash shot. This is the first time we're starting anew. This is a very, very transient time. It calls for, a lot of cooperation. Among them were the greatest, whether there were a number of Kohanim Gadolim that were there, Nevi'im were part of it. I guess they felt that this is an institution, and it wielded a lot of power. I mentioned last time also, it made takanos that are in effect today, laws about businesses, so I guess they didn't want to leave that power with people eventually down the line. That would, they wanted to save it for, we know who these people are, we're going to keep it by us, and then Kali Yisrael will go back to the way it would work. Speculation, I don't know. Okay, the next slide is just the next slide or two, I just, the difference between the Second Temple era. Now, the Second Temple era is different as opposed to the First Temple era. Again, we mentioned there's going to be no more prophecy. In terms of a Ruchni estate, we're going to go down and down. But there's no prophecy. There was no Aram. We mentioned last time different things in the Beis HaMikdash that weren't there. There's about 10 things in the Beis HaMikdash that wasn't there, especially the Aram. So the Beis HaMikdash was like almost like a shell of itself. It wasn't as full, had as much kedusha that the first Beis HaMikdash had. There was no Aron in there. There was a Kachet Kedashim without an Aron. I'm sorry?
Where was the majority of the Jewish people living at that time? The Second Temple era? Were they in Israel?
At the beginning, most of them are in Bava. I mean, like 80%.
Why there's no prophecy?
Yeah, it could be. I'm not an expert in prophecy, so. But I think but if I'm not mistaken, from what I remember reading or learning, that in order to become a prophet, you have to start in Eretz Yisrael. So if you didn't start in Eretz Yisrael, you weren't able to have prophecy. That's why it was important. Yirmiyahu, the community there, they accused Yirmiyahu of wanting to stay in Eretz Yisrael only because Baruch and Arya didn't have Nevoah yet, which was not true. But that's one of the things. You're right. Anybody coming from Bavel was not able to have Nevoah. Daniel, though, I don't think we call Daniel a Navi, but he had some Ruach HaKodesh. He had these visions, and he was able to see things. We do know Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, they gave Nevoah outside. Yonah, they had Nevoah outside of Eretz Yisrael. So I think you had to start with Nevoah in Eretz Yisrael, You continue. When they came back, so I remember learning in the Nechemya, there were many people that were trying, were working towards gaining prophecy.
Because I remember reading in Ari Kaplan that one of the requirements is necessary but not sufficient for Nevuah to be restarted in Israel is the majority of people have to actually reside in Israel.
But definitely Klal Yisrael has to be at a certain level. It has to be at a certain level, otherwise if you need the base there. If without the base, then the additions. We mentioned this time with Shmuel HaKatan, who we're going to mention about. They said he would have been worthy to have Nevuah, but Klal Yisrael at that time wasn't ready. Eventually what's going to happen is in within a short time, most of the Jews, or if not the large minority, is going to be moved to Eretz Yisrael, or be in Eretz Yisrael. So they're not, I don't think, the community of Babel is always going to be there, and it was going to be populous, but it's, in Eretz Yisrael, it becomes as many, maybe they get a little more, but it could be at some point they become a majority. And then comes Herod, and things happen. Okay, the Sanhedrin. Most of the time, the Sanhedrin was powerless. There were times, especially in the beginning, that they didn't wield power. But when the Hashmonaim kings came in, so they took away some of the powers. The kings, they had to always fighting. There's going to be a lot of political infighting. You have the office of the Kohen Gadol, which the king or the office of the king and. And especially when Herod came in, Herod killed them all, killed the entire Sanhedrin. So I'm sure they didn't have any power. Whatever they brought it back, but they didn't do anything under Herod. Herod was about 100 years before the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash. The kings that are going to be there are not going to be from the house of David. The first kings are going to be from the Hashmonaim. Which we'll see if we can get close to this week. If not, not next week, we should hopefully get to the Hashmonaim, maybe even to Hanukkah. So the Hashmonaim, they're going to have the king. So at some point, the king and the Kohen Gadol is going to actually share the position, which is what really happened as early as Shimon HaTzadik. Shimon HaTzadik was the leader of the Jewish people. He was the political leader. He was the one who went out to greet Alexander the Great. At the same time, he was the Kohen Gadol, which was so different in the first Beis HaMikdash. The first Beis HaMikdash, the Kohen Gadol was the religious leader, and the king was the political leader, which saved a lot of problems, because when you have your religious leader as the political leader as well, so religion and government don't mix so well. You see here in America, they're trying to keep that balance of freedom of religion, and yet not, just they're trying to strike that right balance. But, if you're the main religion and you're the government, then everything is great. But if you're not, and you're going against, and at the same time you also have the Sanhedrin, or the Pirushim, or the rabbis, and those days, today we call them the Charedim, but in those days the Pirushim, they were also a force. So you're going to have a lot of political forces there. And not just parties, just these were the ways, these were forces that are going to interact and with each other. In the first Beis HaMikdash, the Kohen Gadolim, there was a total of 18. In 410 years, there were 18 Kohen Gadolim. In the second Beis HaMikdash, there were over 300. Now, the second Beis HaMikdash was 420 years. Yanai Kohen Gadol, it says, was Kohen for 80 years. And why were there so many? Because at some point, especially when the Romans realized they could make a quick buck, they sold it, and they would sell it, and somebody would become a Kohen Gadol. And we all, at least I remember being told, I don't know how accurate this was, but comes Yom Kippur, it's time for a new Kohen Gadol. But it could be that they even sold the for a few months, Kohen Gadol for a few months, and then they just kept selling the office to somebody else. And also in the second Beis HaMikdash, there were no open miracles. Also in the second Beis HaMikdash, other political realities. In the first base of Mikdash, the enemies, so to speak, or the people they had to contend with, were like the cousins, you know, brothers, cousins. People, mainly the Assyrians, the Babylonians, all these people have the same culture. So it's not, they weren't strange people. They could all talk to one another, Hebrew, Aramaic, all sister languages, sister types of cultures, you know, similar cultures. And it wasn't such a, big difference in terms of, wars and different peoples. However, when the Greeks burst on the scene, and they will about 50, 60 years after the Beis HaMikdash, after the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah come in, they start, that's going to be a totally different ball of wax. That's going to be a totally different, and the Romans, bigger contrast in terms of what the Jews are, what their beliefs are, and as opposed to what the Greeks and the Romans are. Okay, so now let's start with the Greeks. So the only thing is, what do we know about the Greeks? Does anybody know the first time that the Torah or any of the Tanakh speaks about the Greeks? Anybody? Oh, before we get this, any questions about the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the second? Okay.
How long after Ezra came did they build the second base of Mikdash?
The second base of Mikdash was built during very, very shortly after. He built it.
So a few months after?
It could have been a few months, probably not more than a year or two. But again, when they built the building, it was very unimposing.
It was within the 70-year period, though. That doesn't just the 70-year
right,
build
right.
Doesn't just mean coming back. It means the Beis HaMikdash was actually built within the 70 years.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, at least the Beis HaMikdash was the first time it was started before it was stopped. That was for
right.
Sure within the 70 years.
That wasn't the real 70 years. That was before the 70
right,
years.
Right, so there were different times when you can count 70 years. What Rabbi Javelin is referring to is that there was a nevuah of Yirmiyahu that the Beis HaMikdash would be rebuilt from the destruction for second Beis HaMikdash will be rebuilt in 70 years. So the question is where do you start the 70 years from? So one started it from the ascension of Nebuchadnezzar. The next one started it from the first, when Nebuchadnezzar exiled the first king, the first exile, which was King Yechenia, and then there was another exile that came later. So where do you start your 70 years? Belshazzar, he thought it was one of them, and that's when the hand came down and wrote on the wall. Achashverosh made another cheshbon, and that was his year-long party. And before that party, the Beis HaMikdash had started to be built. Okay, so now we're at the Greeks. Now the first time, I guess we know. First time is Yafis. So it says that Yafis, the bracha that Noach gave to Yafis, is that the beauty of Yafis will be in the tents of Shem. Tents referring to the base medrash of Shem, and Yafis, the beauty, I guess, the Greek language or the Greek a little bit of culture. And I guess more particularly he's referring to, which we'll see later, is when the Torah was translated into Greek. And that's the first time. There's another time by Shlomo HaMelech. It says, if you read in the beginning of Malachim, so the wise men of Altuna, which are Athens, came to Shlomo and he sent them with Chachma. So I think Mepharshim there said he sent them, he put the bug of philosophy in them. And they had a chachma, they had a philosophy, they were into thinking, and a lot of our modern day thought comes from the Greeks. So that's the first time that we come along the Greeks. And now we're going to move way down the line because we're just looking for the Greeks during that period. Now, just before I start, I don't know how to pronounce a lot of these names. So if I'm going to say the word wrong, either please correct me or just say, wait a minute, that doesn't sound right. So so I'm not exactly sure of all these Greek names that we're going to go to. But I just want to first go to the just a little bit of the Greeks at war. So between 500 and 400 B.C., there was a number of wars. Two of the wars were against Persia, And one of the wars, and then besides that, a whole bunch of wars between Athens, Sparta, Thebes, a lot of other things going on. And by the way, this is when we read in Megillus Esther that, you know, Mordechai, you know, he went out to war and they were successful. So it's it could be talking about some of these wars against Persia. What was the background? First of all, Greece is a terrible, terrible country to be, terrible topography to be to have a country, because it has mountains that are unpassable. It's a lot of water in between. It's just very hard to have one unified country. And in fact, I guess for that reason, they had like city-states. I think they had about 200, about a lot of city-states that were all over the place. And some of the big ones, well, we know the two big ones, the two major ones, is going to be Athens and Sparta. Those are the two ones. Now, as because of the way they were, so they needed the Athens in particular, because Athens was very near the port, near the sea. Sparta was more inland, so Athens always had themselves a navy. They were always seafarers. Greece was seafaring. They had to be, because that's the way they were. They were on the Mediterranean. They had all their islands. And oh, by the way, if you take a look, you see all the islands there, right? So remember, it says in the Megillus Esther that Ahasuerus had how many countries? 127. So it says that 100 of them were on the mainland, and 27 of them were islands. So this probably shows only the bigger ones here, but from the Persian Empire, it were 27 of these islands that were under the Persian Empire, at least at the time of Mordechai. Now what happens is, it says that they learned astronomy from the Babylonians, the alphabet from the Phoenicians, which is very, very, okay. That's the Greek Chachma. That's how they developed the culture, language, etc. Now, what happened is, I guess in the year, was it 519, Persia was interested in conquering a little area called, these are called, again, I don't know how to say it, but I think it's the Ionian Greeks. And it was, these are probably people that were more associated themselves with Greeks. It was Ionian. And that's what they were looking to conquer. So when this was happening, so the Ionians sent a message to Athens, and they said, please help, you know, we're being attacked. And Athens said, yeah, okay, sure. And they sent a fleet of ships to go ahead and help Ionian. In any case, they were very unsuccessful, the Athenians, and they actually did not help at all. There was no... all that did is it got the Persians very upset. They said, "What the nerve? Who are these people coming in and interfering with our business?" And the Persians said, "That's it. We're going after the Greeks." So in 490, Dariush. Now, which Dariush is this? Is this the Dariush before Ahasuerus, or is this the Dariush after Ahasuerus? So again, this is what we mentioned one of the last times, is it's very unclear. We only have four kings in the from our tradition. It was Dariush, Cyrus, Ahasuerus, Dariush. And that the Dariush after Ahasuerus was Esther's son, and he was the one that gave the Jews permission to go back. But we know that there are about 11 of, in the same period, the secular's version to history has about 11 or 13. There were three Ahasuerus's or Exerkes or Artaxerkes, Darius's, at least three. So which one this was in Gabi us, I'm not sure. It probably was not the Dariush that let the Jews go back. Although it may vary. I take that back. I'm not sure. So Dariush said, okay, that's it. We're going after the Greeks, and they made an attack in a place near, I guess, called Marathon, and they got on land, and they realized that the Greeks really did fighting much different than the Persians. Persians had archers, they had horsemen, And the Greeks, they had none of these. All they had is they had like the phalanxes, what do they call it, phalanxes? They had, they got together in a box, and they had shields and swords.
Phalanxes,
thank you. So that's how they did their battles. But they were fierce. The Greeks were fierce warriors. And what also the Greeks had to their advantage, which I'll mention it more later, is that the Greeks did not hire soldiers. They didn't have soldiers of fortune. And the Persian army was all paid soldiers. So when you're fighting for your own homeland, you're going to fight a lot, meaning more. You're going to give a lot more than if you're just a paid soldier. And, you know, a paid soldier, if it's my life on the line, so if I'm, you know, getting too close, I'm out of here. But if you're volunteering, or you are, you know, protecting for your homeland, so you're going to be a different type of a soldier. So he went in and they attacked. So they realized the Greeks were very very strong, and then they decided to attack Athens by sea. So, but while they were loading the boats, they were attacked in Marathon, and they destroyed a lot of the Persian fleet. And the Persians decided, that's it. Okay, they're going home. That's it. And they never made it to Athens. And that's the famous thing, is that this one person, they told this one person, go to Athens and tell them that we were victorious. So the next slide is that this is he ran 26 miles, and he got to, his name was, I can't even say it, Phidias. And he got to Athens. He said, rejoice, we conquered, and died. But just, if you do one of the marathons today, 26 miles marathon, this is where it comes from. The Persians weren't through, and what they decided to do is they came back, and then it took them another 10 years to get their armies and everything together. And this time they came in two ways. They came both in the land and on the sea. And if it's probably the same Darius. Darius is the Xerxes. The Xerxes that they say is ours is Xerxes, the second Xerxes. So this probably is still before the time of Purim. So they come in this time with a force of 200,000 men. And say 2,000 ships. Okay. So this is a gets scared and goes to Sparta and says, listen, we need some help over here. How about, let's call in a little bit of a truce. And Sparta agrees. And Sparta and Athens together, they go ahead, and Sparta takes. So what happens is Sparta says, okay, we'll take the soldiers and you take the navy. So that was the way that we're going to do it between the two of them. So Sparta comes up with they come up with 7,000 soldiers, and they waited for them in a place called Thermopylae, I guess, whatever. That's the Thermopylae, and they had 7,000 soldiers there. And they're holding off this army of 200,000, 7,000 soldiers. What they did is they picked a place, a very narrow pass, so the army couldn't get through. And then they held them off for a number of days. And then what happened is that they realized that the Persians figure out a way to get around. So when that happened, so most of the Persian force left. You can go to the next slide. Most of the Persian force left on boats and went home. And they left King Leonidas with 300 men. They stayed around. And for 300 men, for 3 days, 300 men held off 200,000 Greeks. What this did is gave much needed time for Athens and Sparta and everybody to get themselves going. And what happened is when Athens found out that they're coming through down by the Thermopylae, what they did is they took all their men, they emptied the city, and they all went to a place called Salamis. I think it's the next slide here. They left the town. The town of Athens was emptied. They finally beat these 300. These 300 soldiers somebody told them how to get around them. and they surrounded them. I think there's books on this, there's movies on this. This is like they talk about. They're very proud of these 300. So they finally got to Athens. They burnt the city down. And if they burnt the city down, then they went to Salamis to get the people. But that's when they had a hard time because their big boats were not very maneuverable to get the Salamis, and the navy was crushed, destroyed, and the Persians went back home again. When after this happened, so now Athens decided to let's get all their city states together and make an alliance. And the alliance was called the Delian League Alliance. And like everything, you make an alliance, and it was going to be in Athens, and they abused this alliance a lot. And what ended up happening is that Athens felt very, very slighted. Before we get to that, just the next one is, if you ever want to know what the golden age of Greece was, is with Pericles, this is the time Pericles was there, and if you're into Greek history and culture and everything. So this would have been the time. He was a very big in democracy, which means he not even representative democracy. What we have today is we have a Congress, which is voted by people. But he would bring in thousands of people, and they would vote on things. And everybody had a vote in the government. He was the first one to pay government officials. He was very, very pro democracy, as opposed to Spartan, which was an oligarchy. It's businesses or conglomerates, different ways of governing. So what happened then is that this I find very refreshing. I love this slide. Why? Because here we are. I'm learning in our history of so many times Jews against Jews, fighting each other. So Baruch Hashem, we're not the only ones that kill each other. And this is really what really destroyed Greece as their formidable foe. And basically what happened is the Spartans, they said, we don't want your Delian League, and they started the Peloponnesian League. And basically they divided up a lot of the city-states. Some of them went with Sparta, some of them went with Athens, and they beat each other up. And then at some point Thebes came in, and they went after... what really happened with Athens was, undoing of Athens was, is that Athens opened the gate when they were being attacked by Sparta. They opened up the doors and they took all the people from the countryside into Athens, and it caused too overcrowding, and there was plagues, and people died from plagues. And Sparta came in and finished off Athens. And then Thebes came in and started to fight with Sparta. And basically, after all that, that's pretty much what I said. And basically, after all that, they were all weak, and it helped that one more. What came in was, maybe it's on your sheet, it's better. But then came in, gate opened the door for somebody called King Philip from Macedonia. And Macedonia, Macedonia was in the north. That was like if you were in the culture, that's flyover country, what they would call, today at New York, California, and everything is flyover country. The Hicks, rednecks, that's the way they viewed the Macedonians. But they were so weakened from wars among each other that this person by the name of King Philip from Macedonia, he came down and just took it all over. He got in the entire Greece. He conquered the entire Greece. He wasn't a nice man. He had a very strong-willed man. And he had the vision. He was the first one to have a vision of an empire. And he ended up he conquered the entire Greece, assassinated in 336 before the Common Era. And when that happened, his son Alexander, which we all know is Alexander the Great, took over, and he was 20 years old. Within 15 years, Alexander the Great will have died. And those 15 years are going to be a very, very exciting 15 years. Now, Alexander's dream was, first of all, before Alexander's dream, Alexander had a Rebbe. Does anybody know who Alexander's Rebbe was? Aristotle. I mean, I meant Rebbe, but his teacher. What Philip of Macedonia did is for his son. You know, he conquered everything. So, it went. Socrates was like a very, very big philosopher who had a Talmud. Plato, who had a Talmud. Aristotle. Aristotle was the Rebbe of Alexander. So. I guess King Philip didn't want his son to be a hick like himself. He wanted him to be cultured, get the way of the world and everything. So he was taught by Aristotle, which could very much help, you know, which could maybe help understand why when Alexander saw the Jews, he was very taken in by them. And he's going to give the Jews like a free pass compared to what he did to the rest of the world. He basically let the Jews alone. I guess when he saw another culture that had chachma, that had reason, that there was something to it, you know, he was brought up with that. He was brought up to appreciate wisdom, chachma, philosophy, etc. But he also had a plan, is that he had the wisdom and the chachma. He wanted to get the entire world to be that way as well. Getting to go to the entire world. And he's going to go conquer. He's going to go past... going to go past Persia, he's going to go even into India, but he first goes, he first meets up with, as you can see, first he conquers Asia Minor. Is there a, just want to see if there's a, do I have a map on the next one? Yeah, just quickly go to two more, where it says Empire of Alexander the Great. So just the short form is he starts here in Macedonia. Within a very short time, he conquers Asia Minor. He then goes down. This is where he comes to Yerushalayim. He meets up with Shimon and Tzadik, conquers Egypt, and then Persia. He has he'll have two battles with the king of Persia. The first battle he wins, but the king of Persia escapes. And he had a second battle where then he kills the king of Persia, marries the king of Persia's daughter, and among his other times that he married. And then he goes after Persia, he then keeps going into India, and then after about 11 years of this fighting, his men really had a coup. They said, enough is enough, we want to go back home. And then they started to go back home. When he got back to Babylon, Babel, he died in Babel out of malaria, I think it was, or whatever. He died in Babel. And we'll discuss what happens afterwards. But if anybody could see over here, how many places, how many cities of Alexandria there are there? It must be wherever he went, he started a city called, he planted a city called Alexander. Just go on to the next one. Okay, so we're going to, I guess, pick up what the Greek Empire. Now, just, I guess, we're going to start next time of Alexander, as you can see, conquered massive parts of the world. I mean, this is more than anybody could ever, you know, like twice as much as the Babylonian Empire, Persian Empire. He had the Greek, conquered Persia, and went even more east and conquered India. And so for a time, he had such a large empire. And the question is going to be, is how do you keep it all together? And that's what we're going to see, what Alexander's trick was, or what the Greek trick was. And that's also going to be part of the problem when you get to Eretz Yisrael. Because when you get to the Jews, because the Jews are not going to, it's going to be something which is going to see how the Jews are going to react the way the empire building of the Greeks. So hopefully we'll get even into at least touch about the story of Hanukkah, at least the reasons why Hanukkah came about.